midos. If you made a list of the classic midos that appear in Svarim, you'd come up with tefillah and hasmada and anivos and minat machavero and zrizos. And Rav Lichtenstein felt that if you're an Oved Hashem, every aspect of human character has to be improved. Every part of your personality. If you were to disassemble human personality, what are the traits? The 50 traits that make up your personality, each of those traits has to be perfected. Each of those traits is perfecting a Kodesh Baruch Hu's masterpiece. Hashem created you. Hashem created you with all these parts of your personality. And you have to operate at highest capacity in every aspect of personality traits, even if it's not the classic ones, because there's no such division between the classic midos and the from midos and the religious midos. It's all Avodas Hashem. It's all Shvi'is Hashem L'Negdi Samid. It's how you make yourself into the best person possible, intellectually, emotionally. What traits? And we saw this not just in how Rav Aaron spoke to us, but the type of person we saw on display. So one of the traits that he spoke about a lot is the trait of a work ethic. How do you work in life? Why should you work hard? Now you can claim, well, you should work hard in mitzvahs, but what about things that aren't mitzvahs? What about things that are just life, duties, tasks? So speaking about it, because it's Parshas Vayetze. In Parshas Vayetze, we see Yaakov working feverishly. And when the Rambam, describes Hilchos Schiros and honesty in the workplace, which, by the way, one of the big things, you can't be from at home and in shul and not think about what it means to be an Oved Hashem in the workplace. Because then essentially you're being from for a couple hours a day. You're all going to work 12 plus hours a day. If you have an easier job, 10 hours a day, no one's going 9 to 5. You're not going to be maintenance men in your local school janitors. You're going to be working 6, 7, early morning. So unless you can say, well, when I go to work, what does it mean to continue my Avodas Hashem? How do I talk to the people there? What do I represent there? Obviously, Ellie can tell you a lot about that, being in the workplace. Obviously, honesty, integrity. So the Rambam actually cites in the end of Hilchos Schiros, cites Yaakov as the epitome, the exemplification of honesty. I'm not talking about honesty tonight, I'm talking about why work hard. Like, why should you work? Why shouldn't you be lazy? Why shouldn't you be just, well, why is it good to work? So the guys who come along, Rav Aaron told us to improve every aspect of our personality, not just the classic 6 or 7 midos that are associated with learning, davening. Like, how do you become as great a person as you can be? So let's take a look at source number one. Hashem places Adam in Gan Eden. This is the perfect world. This is before the fall. This is before the sin. And what does he expect of us? We think sometimes that work is just a fallout of Gan Eden. In Gan Eden, we lavished and luxuriated on hammocks, and everything was smooth and available. And then we failed, and then we disobeyed, and then Hashem casts us out and expelled us. And as a punishment, now we have to work. Yes?
Wasn't it also about
Hashem's
commandment to
human
to
prove a will? Right. But before the fall. So work in Tanakh, we're talking about work now, work isn't a punishment because we were expelled from Gan Eden. Work is at the heart of the human identity, the human condition. Hashem expects human beings, even under ideal conditions, to be involved in some work. Maybe the work conditions were exacerbated or complicated when we left Gan Eden. Now it's hard, now we struggle, it's difficult, it's overwhelming. But work itself, he expects human beings to be workers. And if you don't work, you're betraying your basic expectation, like you're acting inhuman. And to highlight this, Rav Aaron quoted a really well-known Gemara in Sanhedrin. Gemara in Sanhedrin lists a whole bunch of people who apostle this midrabanan. Look at source number 4. Elohim apsulin. Not the people who apostle minatar, people who apostle midrabanan. One of them is a mesachik v'kuvi. You all know this, someone who gambles. So the Gemara says, why is mesachik v'kuvi apostle this? So the first day in the Gemara is because it's theft. You're taking people's money against their will. It's called a smachta. Smachta is theft. But then the Gemara recovers and says, we may not paskin that a smachta is theft. The smachta may be kanya, may not be theft, which, by the way, good chance to announce. In yeshiva, there's no gambling, not because it's mutter or aser, it's just it's unhealthy socially. Gambling is corrosive. People lose money. It creates tensions, have and have-nots. So please, this isn't religious. This is just to keep the yeshiva a healthy environment that everyone can just be. Again, we're not really in the period of gambling yet, but it's going to come in the Super Bowl, March Madness. Gambling, especially in institutional settings, is not healthy. That's why we're not going to get into that discussion. Motor, asa, there's a lot to discuss, but just a good chance to make that sidebar note. It's illegal just here, same way, you know, I don't know, other type of antisocial behavior. Setting fire to your room would be illegal, it would be fair to your roommate. So don't set fire to your room, don't gamble. So, second day of the Gemara is gambling is mutter, because everyone puts the money on the table and knows there's a chance they'll lose. So, asmachta is kanya. So, what does the Gemara say? So, if asmachta is a kinyan, and you're not considered a gana, and you're not stealing anyone's money, why are you possibly edus? So, the Gemara says, very powerful Gemara. Because you're not producing anything. You're not contributing anything. You're just gambling your life away. Part of being a human being and being kasher le'edus and being fulfilling your task, your identity Hashem gave you, is to contribute. If you don't contribute anything, you're subhuman. You're pasul le'edus because you're like a slave. You're not invited to say edus. You don't factor in. That was one of the revolutions when I met Rav Lichtenstein. When I was growing up in high school, I had two things on my mind when thinking about a profession. The two factors that were weighing on my mind were financial remuneration and time for learning. I really wanted time to learn. I really wanted to make a lot of money. And if you told me that I could sell hot dogs at Madison Square Garden for 4 hours a day and make a lot of money and learn the rest, I'd be there. And Rav Aaron introduced a whole new factor into my calculus. That factor was, are you contributing to human welfare? And that has to weigh heavily. Because that's who you are. And we say you're spending 10 hours a day, 12 hours a day, training, professional. And obviously there are trades and professions that are more directly yeshiva shalom, medicine, education, social welfare, psychology, public administration, public leadership, whatever. And then there are some that are pretty far. But a lot of it is what you make of it. You can become a lawyer and overcharge your clients and be cynical, exploit people, and lie, and... Or you can say, look, I'm going to become a lawyer because for whatever reason, the decision I make, a lot of factors that go into the decision. But I see myself as a cog in a larger system. If I don't work for Microsoft, then they can't protect their intellectual property, and therefore they can't produce software, and people don't have computers. Again, it's not like people are going to write you letters, thank you so much for being the lawyer in the Microsoft-Google litigation. But at some point, you're a cog. It's a question of attitude also. Again, I hope that a lot of people seriously think about professions that really directly contribute, maybe missing some, but those that directly, day-to-day, you feel as if you're changing people's life and bettering people's lives. But even if not, don't get caught into that place where your profession is to make money and free yourself time. You have to see yourself as contributing to the world around you. And if you don't, you're just a gambler. Again, it's not the gambling. It's not the nefarious gambling. It's you're just not doing anything. You're not contributing. You're just spinning your wheels. You're not contributing anything. So the question is, why? Why is a work ethic so important? We know that it is. We know that Hashem expects it of us. We know that if we fail, we're possibly this. But what about a work ethic? Like, why? Well, okay, tell me, why is it so important to work hard? That's why we're here, right? If you tell me, you've heard this from me so many times, so many contexts, you got to learn how to like working. You got to push yourself to work. You're working this yeshiva. Have a lot of visitors this week, and they all said, wow, this is a place where people are really working. They really feel there's a lot of hard work on. So why? Why is it such an important part of your identity? So I want to discuss three things. Number one, because not working is dangerous. Number two, because working ennobles you. And number three, because working creates some partnership with the Kodesh Baruch. Let's talk about those three issues, a short summary of why it's important to be someone that likes working, that performs tasks at all levels, physical labor, mental work, just committing yourself to tasks. So the Gemara says in Ksuvos, it sounds a bit chauvinistic, but again, in their social context, it was fitting. A woman has a whole list of domestic chores that she's responsible for. Cooking, cleaning, knitting, sewing, making the bed, the whole nine yards. But she can be relieved of her duties if she's very wealthy, and as part of her dowry, she brings servants along with her. So if you marry a wealthy woman, she brings one servant, the domestic list shrinks. She brings two servants, even less. Three servants, even less. And if she has four servants, let's pick up the Mishnah here, source number six. Okay, Arba, if she brings in four servants, she's really wealthy and four servants are part of her dowry, Yosheves Bikadaterta. She can just sit in her cathedral all day and relax. She can play with her cats in her yarn. throw the balls of yarn, can't pick it, bring it back. Throw the bone, play with her peacocks, play with her dogs. She's rich, she's wealthy. There are cookers, there are cleaners, there are bedsetters, everyone's there. At which point, Rabbi Eliezer Omer, she can have 100 servants. Kofa lasos bitsemer. She still has to knit. In those days, knitting was difficult with Mr. Pastor. She still has to knit, make clothing. Why? Here's the key line, money shot, backside. Shabbatala mevia lidezima. People that are sitting around doing nothing, bad things happen. or, you know, the expression, idle hands, tools of the devil. Idle thoughts, laboratory of the devil. Basically, you don't have a schedule, you're not working, you're aimless, you're sitting around. What happens to all of us when we don't occupy our time properly, our time gets occupied by negative, toxic, sometimes really toxic, sometimes just negative, counterproductive, unhealthy. Busy people generally tend to be drawn to healthy environments. Non-busy people, idle people, tend to fall into bad places. So people need to get jobs, people need to work. In fact, Rav Lichtenstein had a stunning read of a Gemara in Sanhedrin. Take a look at the Gemara, source number 10. Very famous Gemara, Rish Lakish, Nachri Shabbos Chayav Misa. A guy can't keep Shabbos because it's our personal, intimate relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. You're invading. And thank God, history has protected Shabbos. So the Christians wanted a day, they chose Sunday. The Muslims wanted a day, they chose Friday. So Hashem protected Shabbos. It's an amazing historical phenomena that was protected, even though every single major religion wanted to take that day. Shabbos was indomitable, was impenetrable. Okay. So if a guy intercedes, it's Chayav Misa. You'll know the old joke about the Chavrusa. It's an old yeshiva joke. Guy's a Chavrusa. Moshe and Mordechai for 45 years. At one point, Mordechai says, Moshe, I got this little secret I have to tell you. I really haven't shared it with anyone. It's very private, but I'm really not Jewish. I'm just learning from the intellectual stimulation, and I'm not really into it. I'm making good Chavrusa. And Moshe says, I can't believe it, Mordechai. What are you telling me? It's crazy. We've been learning together for so long. You seem so into I'm not a good chavrusa, but I'm not Jewish. And then Moshe says, oh my goodness, I just realized, you keep Shabbos. You've been keeping Shabbos your whole time. You come over, you walk, you're not driving, so I've seen you, you keep Shabbos. Gemara in Sanhedrin, we learned it seven times, Daf Yomi. Gai Shabbos, Nachri Shabbos, Chayav Misa. You're Chayav Misa, Mordechai. Or should I call you now Mars? Mars says, you didn't realize. Every Shabbos I walked out to the Shas Rabbim, I learned the halachas. I put a key in my pocket that no one saw. So I should break Shabbos. No one really saw. I was hanging out with the Jews, but put a little key in my pocket, walking over with the key, really broke Shabbos. So Moshe says, Morris, don't you realize there's an Erev in town? You didn't break Shabbos. We have an Erev. So Morris says, I don't hold by that Erev. I'm fasting against that Erev. I don't hold by that Erev. He's a guy. I don't hold by that Erev. Even the guy argued about the Erev. Anyway, so Nachri Shabbos Chayav Misa, invading our Saturday. But look at this next shita. I'm a Ravina, line number 3, source 10. I feel a sheni b'Shabbos. Even if a guy were to choose Monday as his Shabbos, again, or Sunday for that matter, but like a real Shabbos, not just a Sunday off with football and barbecues, but a real, real Shabbos on Sunday or Monday, he'd be Chayav Misa according to Ravina, which is amazing because they're not invading our Shabbos. We don't keep Shabbos on Monday. So why are they Chayav Misa? One thing, the first Shita, Nachri Shabbos on the seventh day, that's ours. O.C. B'nir Ben B'nai Yisrael. But Monday's not ours, it's a regular day. Wash the B'chayim Misa. Rav Aaron said that you can't establish a universal, comprehensive, non-work day unless you're chayif. And if you do, you're betraying Hashem's expectation. It's impossible to conceive of a human being or human community saying, we are collectively going to decide not to work this day. To institutionalize indolence, to institutionalize unemployment, to say, we're going to take a day off and shut it down. If you do that on any day, you're Chayav Misa. The only people that have the right to do that are the Jewish people because Hashem gave us a commandment. But without that commandment, it would be such a betrayal of whom we are. It would be so unhealthy just to be idle collectively for one day not to produce anything. And that's why you guys Chayav whether keep Shabbos or Monday. To institutionalize a day of no work across the board, nationally, historically, is inconceivable. Now we have to because we're reaching something higher. We're reaching Kadosh Baruch Hu rested. We rest. But absent of that framework, and they don't have the framework. So that's the first issue. The first issue is, and you see this, right? I mean, I guess some of you probably already at the stage where as vacation rolls on, you're getting a little tired of it. You don't feel good about yourself. You're not producing another day and another food and another more. And just, you fall into bad habits. And then when you're a framework and a routine, you got great habits. Which, by the way, is just a great lesson if you find yourself falling into bad experiences and just trying to bolster and reinforce your work ethic and your schedule. Just come on time. And if you're in the right place at the right time, you probably will save yourself from a lot of moral collapses and moral challenges. The second issue is, it doesn't just protect us, but it also ennobles us. We'd like to think there are certain parts of our personality that working hard amplifies and strengthens. It builds our self-esteem. Self-sufficient people feel better about themselves. They're not reliant on other people. Successful completion of tasks. Working hard. We employ our creativity. Even in menial tasks is great creativity. I have some more creativity in coding a computer program than in digging a ditch. But even in digging a ditch, how should you dig? How hard should you work? Pacing yourself. Anytime you expend, I mean, most work is creative. Most work is, you're not just digging a marsh. You're not just throwing dirt from one side to the other. It's project-oriented. It's stages. It's planning. Again, it could be cerebral. It could be, I'm someone who's very cerebral, so I spent a lot of my time in a cerebral environment in terms of the work that I do. I'm an emotional person, but I use my mind exhaustively. I like when I get to use my hands and build around the house and put things together. It gives me a feeling of accomplishment that I could accomplish. I'm not reliant on other people. It also steers you away from self-interest. Not all work, but work in general produces for other people, contributes to other people. One of the greatest traps, there's so many verbal traps in our modern society. One of the verbal traps is the word consumer. Those of you who studied economics. Consumer confidence. How's consumer confidence these days? That will send ripple effects through the economy. Consumer price index. That will affect the economic flow. Okay, in an economic forum, these are important phrases. But what's happening is it's duping us into profiling ourselves as consumers. Chalila v'chas, we're not here on this earth to consume. What are we here on this earth? We're producers. We're supposed to produce and change and improve our world. Could you dare imagine yourself as a consumer? What are you, a carnivore, a herbivore? You're here to consume? Now to produce, you have to consume, right? You have to consume. You need to consume resources. You need to consume food. You consume time. But to define yourself as a... Just think about the chaos of Black Friday. There's the celebration of how much we can consume, how many goods we can consume. And I hope that for the rest of your life. Again, our goal overall, and I'll talk about this a lot when we get to the Super Bowl week, our goal overall is not to yank you from the culture. Our goal overall is for you to be able to control the culture rather than being controlled by it. You know, to say, this is what I choose to watch, it's what I don't choose to watch. Or I choose to watch one show, not to binge. I choose to watch when I want, not when I don't want. I want to go to the chavrusa, not. Basically, there's so much out there that's dangerous, but each person... That's a larger conversation about shutting down, but at the very least, not to be enslaved by it. So I happened to buy a couple things this year on Black Friday because I've been waiting for them for about 3-4 months. So I wanted the sales to kick in. I'm going to the States next week, so it's perfect. It's delivering. So I wasn't a Black Friday victim. I knew that my wife needed a laptop. I knew that I needed a watch. I knew they needed some socks. So I held out. I can save myself a little bit. It wasn't like, it's Black Friday. I got to go buy something. I got to consume. And my normal routine as a consumer, there are certain needs my family has. I said, some of the things I bought earlier, we couldn't wait. Some of the items, I said, you know, we wait 3 months, we'll get a better deal, we'll wait, we'll buy it then. That's a healthy way. Unhealthy way is, I got to have the next phone. I got to wait online all night outside the Apple store. Or I got to celebrate the phone, walk in the next intro. That's unhealthy consuming. Very interesting. We think that Hashem directed Avraham to Eretz Yisrael, Lech Lecha, and he knows where. Beautiful matters. Let's read this matters together. Source number 7. Amar Reb Levi. Reb Levi comments. B'shay shay Avram mehalech b'aram narayim v'aram nachar. Avram is hobnobbing around Syria, Iraq. He's not really sure because Hashem doesn't tell him where this land is. So this Medrash presents it as if Avram has a say in the matter. And Avram can choose Israel, he can choose France, he can choose Iraq. Okay, France maybe not because he can't cross the sea. But in this area, he has a choice. And he's traveling throughout all the land, and he sees them, ra'osan ochlim v'shosim upochazim. He sees them just relaxing and indulgent. Amri says, halavai lo yehe lichelik baretz hazels. I don't want to live with these people when he's in Iraq and Syria, wherever those places are. Kivan shehigia l'sulama shel tzor. Then he reaches Israel. The northern boundary of Israel then was Tyre, the city of Lebanese city, Tyre, tzor. He reaches the Lebanese-Israel boundary. What does he see? Fascinating medrash. Why does he choose Israel? He chooses Israel in this medrash. He has a choice and he chooses Israel. Why does he choose Israel? They're all paganists. They're all barbarians. They're all savages. What does he see in this local population that makes it so attractive? So the medrash says, Reos masukim benichosh b'shas anichosh. He sees him plowing, planting, harvesting. He says, these are people I want to live with. people who work. There's no religious component. They're not believers. They're not theologians. They're not moral. They're just workers. He says, I want to be with workers. It's going to be healthy for me to be with people that like to work. And there's a little hidden message here. If you look carefully at the Medrash, they're not just workers, but they're consistent and scheduled and paced. A lot of boys, and again, you know, you are better than myself. Most of you are not in my shiur, so I'm not like clocking you day by day. So I'm just, you know, saying hello to you when you're around, asking questions to become. A lot of boys your age go really hot and cold. They'll spend 2-3 days working hard, and then 2-3 days just recovering. And sometimes it's really hot and cold, 2-3 days till 2-3 in the morning, and then 3 days they're in the witness protection program. You can't find them. That's really hot and cold. And the truth is, it takes a lot of patience for teachers, and I know the arc that a lot of boys go through. We're not going to sit there and hover above you. But the sooner that you can get into consistency, especially, you know, pull off those weeks where you just hear every day and minyan, consistent. It's one of the most underrated traits in life, emotional consistency. I mean, if you ask me, give me 3 traits about being a father, that would be one of them, consistency. You have to be the consistent one. The world around you is up and down, frantic, hectic, tense, pressure. You have to be the one that comes in, and you're the same person Monday as you were Tuesday. Well, Tuesday you're in a bad mood, you're the same person. You just provide that baseline where everyone can know that you, because if everything in everyone's world is chaotic and unpredictable, then life is all helter-skelter. If they say, oh, okay, my father's in, I know he's going to be there, and he's going to keep it calm and keel and even, and he's not going to scream. He may have slept more, may have slept less. May have a cold, may not have a cold. Maybe pretends, maybe not tends. It's going to be the same feel. You'd be surprised how stabilizing it is for people. And those of you who have that in your father generally, but it could be in both, you know how important that is. You're going to look back at your life and say, oh, I was in bed, I was a cook, I was having a hard time, my girlfriend, but I just came back and I was able to settle into that old slipper, call my father, put my foot into the old slipper, feel comfortable, regroup. That's what home is in general. As you leave, home should be a safe place. And it's very important when you start your family to make your home a safe place for your children. There's a lot of tension in the world. There's a lot of antagonisms, a lot of confrontation. And home should be a safe place. We go home, no one judges you. Obviously, they help you. Obviously, they talk about you. But you're at home. We love you unconditionally. And you can just feel comfortable here. And that's the secret of big families, by the way. That's what people who don't have big families, who wonder, how do you raise big families, don't understand. Because the more that you have, the more you build a community, and the more love you can share, and the more support you can give. So if you have 10, I don't know, 10 kids, we have 10 kids in the family, and everyone more or less gets along and supports, right off the bat, you have 10 people in this world that you feel ratify you and legitimize you and validate you. And that's a strong feeling. People don't realize when they ask the Haredi culture, how do they do it? They don't have money, they don't have funds, small little apartments. Okay, so some people don't, but in many ways, the family comes first. The family is almost the mechanism of life. Everyone contributes to the family, and that family, you'd be surprised how powerful the concept of a family. Be conscious of when you build a family. Some of you are not conscious of, build my career, build my marriage, and I'll raise my kids. Okay, those are all morally fine statements, but there's something else called building a family. How do you build a family? How do you build family dynamics? How do you build that family unit that will support it? And some, sadly enough, you see people don't have that. Sometimes the family breaks apart. The kids are still raised, but the family's not that. Sometimes the family stays together, but you don't have the healthy dynamics that allow the family to coexist and cross-pollinate one another. So you have to be conscious when you get married, when you choose. Is this woman that I'm marrying, does she understand what it means to build a family, what it takes? And that's not always the smartest girl, certainly not only the prettiest girl. There's a lot of, you want to see the family she, I'm getting a little bit off track, you want to see the family she's part of. Generally, you learn how to build a family by watching other families. It's not exclusive. You can have good friends. You have older families that you're close with. But it's an art. It doesn't happen on its own. Okay? So it's also about routine. That's what Avram sees. He doesn't see hard workers. He sees them working properly when they're plowing. And then it comes to the harvest time, and then it comes to the planting time. There's a pace. They're not, I call them the vampires. A lot of kids your age are vampires. Stay up till 4 or 5 in the morning, then you don't see them until 12:30 or so when you're in college cramming. So college is all right, because that's what college is. You're cramming, you have tests. But you can't be a vampire. Some people can't get out of the vampire stage until they're 45 or 50. They'll just up all night, especially internet, and then they sleep, and it's just, you're off. You're off. Again, if you're a night watchman or you're a trucker, you know, that's your time you're working. But it's really important to be in pace with the world. Be where everyone else is. When they're awake, you're awake. When they're asleep, you're asleep. And that's what makes jet lag so off. You're off. They're sleeping. You're asleep. You're in a different, at a time you feel like out of it. And you're sick and you're not part of the cycle and everyone's moving one way and you're moving the other way. So this is the second reason that a healthy work ethic. It's not just, oh, I want to make sure that I occupy my time so that I don't waste it or worse. But working hard really builds character. Really builds character. I'm interviewing boys and starting next week, and it's really, I'm trying to look at character, who they are as a person. And it doesn't show necessarily on the intellectual metrics. And a lot of it, I ask them, I try to project, because high school, no one really works that hard for sustained periods. So I think there's a lot of hard work here in yeshiva. And I'm trying to project whether they can shift into an environment and work hard and enjoy it. And I'm trying to gauge about them, how they're sitting, how they're looking at me. I'll ask them, what are the hardest things you accomplished in high school? Because generally, I can find places that they worked hard. There were little glimpses of hard work in high school. And they worked hard on this. And then, okay, now you can do it in a sustained fashion, day in, day out. But it's not easy. Not easy to find. Not easy to determine. It's easy to just look at the marks. And there you have good marks. And you have to really try to project these. And the third part of the work ethic is, somehow HaKadosh Baruch Hu made a decision. It's a strange decision, and it bothered the Romans. I'm starting to get near Hanukkah, so I'll talk a little bit about that. But somehow Hashem made a decision to leave this world imperfect. And we don't know why, but we know what he intended, because he wants us to partner with him. He wants us to solve cancer. We will one day. He wants us to solve polio. We did. He wants us to harness energy. We did. Hashem created a world that was imperfect, and he wanted human beings to partner. Now, obviously, we partner with him in the grand parts of our life, inventions, discoveries, math, gravity, sending a man to the moon. But we also partner with Hashem every time we work, and every time we improve ourselves and improve our lot. We're really the only animal that is so industrious. And so the ants build colonies, but we build structures that can keep us warm when it's freezing outside. And beavers build dams, but we build palaces, and we build internets, and we create a better world for ourselves, and Hashem wants us to. And this is the fascinating conversation which took place between Rabbi Akiva and Turnus Rufus. Turnus Rufus, funny name, but Turnus Rufus was a Roman general / theologian. And you have to understand the time. This is a little bit Hanukkah-oriented. Remember, the Greeks and the Romans, I call them transitional. Because they're transitioning the world from the ancient world of gross, glaring paganism. People worship sea monsters and voodoo and planets and oceans and mountains. It's just a real ancient world of black magic and darkness. And we live in the world of ration and enlightenment and monotheism and science. And the Greeks and the Romans, L'chanukah here, transition from one world to the other. It's a very, very important stage in religious history. Roughly 400 BCE to roughly, when did Rome fall? 300, early 4th century. Important 700 years of history, on many fronts, but certainly religiously. If you want a name for it, just to tag it, there's paganism, early stage, monotheism, thank God, our world. Middle stage, you'd call it polytheism. It's theist, that they're not worshiping tables and donkeys and camels and sea monsters and water. But it's polytheist. Namely, there are many. How many Greek gods are there? Mercury, Apollo, Zeus, Diana, whatever. Many other differences, not just the number, but they hadn't yet envisioned the unity of Hashem. The unity of Hashem is so crucial. Hashem Echad. Everything in this world, hot and cold. We used to be in this room, it was hot. Now in this room, it's cold. Day and night, dichotomy, good and evil, fire and water, creature, it all comes from Hashem. I'll talk about this in the Musar. Ali had to go to the hospital tonight. That's when he gave the Musar for his father. I'm going to talk a little bit about Hasidus, because this is a month of Hasidus. and I want you to know what Chassidus is. You know, that's all just stale fish being touched by a rabbi's hands. It's something really deep. I want you to understand a little bit of it. Maybe if you see something happening, we'd have actually an event on Yutes Kislev, having someone come and speak to you, a very, very popular speaker. Well, I'm not going to reveal his identity. Unfortunately, I was responsible for drafting him, recruiting him to come speak, but I'm not going to be here. I'll be in Chicago, I think, the Windy City. But so these polytheists, they were starting to cobble together a more refined version of Judaism, and they knew that the Jews, refined version of religion, they knew that the Jews had it, which is why a formative story of Hanukkah, you can't appreciate Hanukkah without the story that happened about 100 years before. Whereas 100 years before, what happened? Which Greek came to Yerushalayim? You want to know the story? Alexander the Great comes to Yerushalayim about 100 years before Hanukkah, about to destroy Yerushalayim, and Shimon HaTzadik, member of the Anshei Knesset HaGedolah, the Kohen Gadol, comes out to greet him, and Alexander Mokdon is just amazed, intrigued. This is the apparition that came to him every night before his military triumph, and he says, you know, I'll do whatever you want. There are many layers to that story, but the most important layer is the Greeks are coming to Yerushalayim to learn about religion, and they want to take from us. And every time you take, it creates friction and tension and exchange and impurification and adulteration and Hellenism and fights and combat, and that's embroilment. Everything happens 100 years later, the fight, the contest. But essentially, the broader story is the Greeks are coming to learn from us, and we're imparting our knowledge through Shimon HaTzadik to this culture that's going to move humanity forward into the age of reason, science, monotheism. So these conversations between Greeks and Jews, and more particularly between Romans and Jews, they're interesting conversations because they're not, oh, let's incriminate the Jews or try them or put them on trial. They're not just taunting us. They're asking real questions. They're looking for, this isn't taunting. So Tunis Rufus asked Rabbi Akiva, source number 3, a very famous question, Eizem Maisim Noim Shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu Shel Basar V'dam. And he expects Rabbi Akiva to say, HaKadosh Baruch Hu's creations are superior. And you know what the sting is. Well, if HaKadosh Baruch Hu's creations are superior to human creations, why are you circumcising / mutilating God's creation? Because the Romans celebrated the beauty of the human male body. Well, too far, but the Romans felt that circumcision was mutilation. And this is his way of just trapping, but inquiring. Hashem created human beings uncircumcised. God is superior to humans. Why are you marring or disfiguring the divine creation? So if you keep a cut him off the pass, I know where you're heading on this one. Human beings' creations are better. The Tzaddik Rufus does a double take. Amalei lama tem mulam. This is what you're avoiding my question. Why do you get mila? Amalei afani isi adesh atasav namalei kain. I knew Rabbi Akiva says, source number 3, you would ask me this question. I saw it coming. Line number 4. Lekach gdamti v'amarti lecha, source 3. This is why I preempted you when I said, maise basar v'dam heim nami shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and I'll prove it to you. He said to his shamish, please bring me some bread. Go to Pat B'Melech, bring me some bread. Go get some pizza. Go get some English cake. Bring it. And he showed it to the Tzaddik Rufus and said, this is what we've created. But now we're going to make a bracha. And the bracha I'll recite is, Baruch Ata Hashem, Elokeinu Melech Haolam, Hamatzi Lechem Min Haaretz. So, did Hashem create the bread? No. But it's better than chewing on wheat. Hashem created potential. And when we maximize and exploit that potential, we thank Hashem for creating that potential and giving us the ability to maximize. I'll take his wheat, perfect it, improve it, make cookies, dough, bread, and eat it, and thank HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And that's the same thing with me. HaKadosh Baruch Hu created this world intentionally imperfect. And he wants us to perfect our bodies by circumcising. And that's an icon or metaphor for all the perfection of man. When we work, we're partnering with Hashem. We want this world to be a better place. It's a very haunting question. When you leave this world, will you leave a mark? Will there be a mark for your life? And you don't have to go high to answer that question. You raise your family the right way. You bring so many people into this world and they'll ripple the effect. And don't get ahead of yourselves. That's a great way to change the world. I don't know if I told you this story. Story I'll never forget about a Haredi guy who died in... May I should tell you a story in the Chag night? No? When he died, he had close to 1,200 relatives. You do the math, 20 times 20 times 20. He lived to be an old age. And between the time he died and the time he was buried, I think he had 4 weddings, 2 bar mitzvahs, 3 brisim of his descendants. Because there were 1,200 people in this clan. Now, this story resonates a lot with me because I'm at the stage right now, I can't keep track of the Tarragon family. If you ever meet a Tarragon, an Ashkenazi Tarragon, we're all one family. But I don't know. It's hundreds. Thank God. My Zadie moved from White Russia in 1918, 1919, alone and penniless. And he single-handedly brought all of his brothers and parents over. And they would have been stuck in communism and probably killed in the Holocaust if they stayed behind. So one person made a simple decision. He didn't climb Mount Everest. He didn't reinvent the wheel. He just moved and he worked and he saved his pennies and he brought people over. And 100 years, not 2019, 100 years later, there are hundreds of people doing great things in this world because one person. So work doesn't have to be, I'm going to enter a laboratory. It could just be, but the sense that you have to live a life that contributes, that advances, that works. And these are some of the ideas that Rav Aaron expressed to us. Like, don't run away from work. Don't run away from tasks. It's honorable. In my family, when my kids complain, why do I have to take out the garbage? Why do I have to clean the floors? It's your honor. That makes you a better person. It makes you less selfish, less self-centered. Start to try to practice in yeshiva. I can always see the guys who hang around the cleanup or don't hang around the cleanup. The guys who, whenever there's, clean up the room, put the chairs back. Just people naturally gravitate because they know it's not just the chesed. It makes me a better person. And the people always trying to avoid and get away with it and let other people do it. You just end up being on many, many fronts. Idle, lack of energy, self-centered, wasting your time. You want free time. Busyness is good. Now, we talked last week in the Parsha Chuk, sometimes busyness makes you too busy and you become an Aesop and you become too chaotic and too swirl. And so how do you find that balance between always being busy? Again, there's no one value that I'm ever going to tell you, anyone else here will tell you. That's the one unique, unitary value. It's building a puzzle and putting values in place and making sure that it evens out and making sure the whole system has some apogee or zenith that you're trying to peak, you're trying to get to be a better Oved Hashem, and then you get the whole value system. You can't just take a partial statement. And I want to be busy. You're busy your whole life. You're busy your whole life. When are you thinking? When are you dreaming? When are you interacting with people? You don't want to be so busy you don't have time for the people in your life that matter. And the more people in your life that matter, the healthier you are. Right? People in your life will get you. We'll get people and relationships, and I have to end, so I just want to take a second. Always prioritize relationships over accomplishments. I say that so often to you. This world is built upon accomplishments, how much money, how much title, how much. It really doesn't bring happiness. You see so many people accomplished, wealthy, financial, addicted, sad, alone, lonely, frustrated, jealous. And the people that have people and really appreciate each other and live with each other and participate in each other's lives. That leads to happiness. That leads to contentment. And you can't put a price on contentment. You think, again, when you're young, it seems that I seem so cliched, you can't put a price on happiness. It's just really true. The more you lead your life and the more you see people around you, people hanging themselves, people, suicide, crime, just looking for happiness and just not finding it. It has to start from within. And what creates within is meaning, obviously, purpose, hopefully for this person, a Kodesh Baruch Hu. And by and large, people who live your life with and interact with. Okay, let's stop here for a few minutes. We'll start the hug in 3 minutes, at 6:02. Have a quick hug, okay?